Only the victim is alive and the murderers are not. It's a pity you didn't know when you started your game of murder that I was playing too.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Do you believe in ghosts?
First simply disappeared. The other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host and non-destructive Fear Cult leader, Ashley Lana, welcoming you back to the show. Fear Cult, this episode is why I do this podcast. If you're a new listener, allow me to personally thank you for choosing this episode to start on. I have spent, well, I was going to say weeks, but it'd be far longer than that. Because much like the RMS Titanic episode, tonight's case, I have this constant need to know what happened. And I'm continuously checking in due to the amount of possible unsolved victims. And it's another wow episode. That means a worst of the worst. It's far more graphic and the crimes are a lot more horrendous than the average case. So with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last episode, we examined the haunting case of Sutomu Miyazaki, the little girl murderer. He abducted and killed children in Japan. Tonight, we are going to be discussing a case that I am fascinated with, as I said before. This serial killer is almost an enigma in the world of murder. He had friends, he was popular, and he was very handsome. And his narcissism was out of this world. It was as if somewhere deep down in his putrid soul, he attempted to outdo the likes of Ted Bundy himself, simply for his own quiet ego. My sources include People vs. Alcala, 1984, The People vs. Alcala, 1992, The Dating Game Killer by Stella Sands, and More Than Just a Pretty Face, Can You Identify Us? Victims of the Dating Game Killer. So get comfortable. Because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of abduction, crimes against children, sexual assault, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Let's see. Bachelor number one is a successful photographer who got a start when his father found him in a darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling. Please welcome Rodney Alcala. And it's time to meet our young lady for game number one, and here she is. Here's a young lady with a wealth of experience. She once earned a living massaging feet, but she quit when her boss suggested she work her way up. Then she taught school in Phoenix, Arizona, and now she's here to educate our three bachelors in the art of amore. Welcome, if you will, sensational Cheryl Bradshaw! Hello, Cheryl.
Hi.
You know, there are three bachelors over there. There will be one, two, and three. Ask them anything you'd like to find out more about them except their name, age, occupation, or income, okay? We're going to start with number one and see how they sound. Bachelor number one, will you say hello to Cheryl?
We're gonna have a great time together, Cheryl.
Bachelor number one.
Yes?
What's your best time?
The best time is at night. Nighttime.
Why do you say that?
Because that's the only time there is.
The only time? What's wrong with morning? Afternoon?
Well, they're okay. But nighttime is when it really gets good. Then you're really ready.
Drama teacher, and I'm going to audition each of you for my private class. Bachelor number one.
You're a dirty old man.
Take it.
Oh, come on, over here.
Oh, honey, we gotta go out and boogie.
Bachelor number one. I am serving you for dinner. What are you called? And what do you look like?
I'm called the Banana. And I look really good.
Can you be a little more descriptive?
Peel me.
Welcome back to the Day in the Game, and Cheryl, we have reached the moment of truth, as we call it. You've heard from the bachelors, you've got some great dramatic presentations, but now I'm going to ask you a question. Will that date be bachelor number one, bachelor number two, or bachelor number three? Who gets the date?
Well, I like bananas, so I'll take one.
This is the true story of the dating game killer, Rodney Alcala. Rodney Alcala was born Rodrigo James Alcala Bucor on August 23, 1943. He was the second youngest of four children, born into a Mexican-American family from San Antonio, Texas, United States. His father, Raul Alcala Bucor, worked as a Spanish language instructor, while his mother, Ana Maria, stayed at home and raised the children. Unlike many serial killers, Rodney had a healthy childhood. The Alcalas were loving and made plenty of time for family activities. The children got along and suffered no abuse at the hands of their parents. According to those who knew Rodney, he was charming from birth. He was always smiling and had no issues making plenty of friends. In 1951, Rodney's grandmother fell ill and wished to spend the last of her days with her close family. The Alcalas packed up and moved to Mexico for a total of 3 years. At 11 years old, Rodney received devastating news that his father had abandoned the family, and he moved back to the United States. Deep down, Rodney was left fearful and confused, trying to comprehend how his father could leave his wife and children homeless, as if they meant nothing. Upon facing his father's rejection, the abandonment left him with trauma that he couldn't rationalize, and this caused resentment. According to the Journal of Police and Criminal Psychology, traumatic childhood events such as abandonment frequently lead to mental health issues that can be destructive if left diagnosed and untreated. Rodney felt obligated at 11 years old to find ways to help his mother and siblings survive. Taking initiative, Rodney's mother, Ana Maria, packed up the children and moved to Monterey Park, California, to start a new life. In school, Rodney was exceptionally gifted, with an IQ above 140. Reigning at the top of his class, his peers looked up to him. He was charismatic and handsome. In 1956, Rodney completed the 8th grade. He then attended the private Cantwell Sacred Heart of Mary Catholic High School. The strict rules started to push the teen away, and he started to hate religious education. He insisted that he would go to public school instead. As a young teenager, he would go on many dates. Girls found him quite handsome, with his curly head of hair and cheeky grin. He joined the school's cross-country team, and he was even on the yearbook committee, where he found an interest in photography. Rodney Alcala graduated from Montebello High School at 17 years old in 1960. He had a dream of becoming a paratrooper in the Army. When Rodney joined the United States military, he served as a clerk answering phones for an office. Greeting clients and assisting paperwork was not the excitement that he had hoped for. Then, in 1962, Rodney's father passed away, leaving 19-year-old Rodney heartbroken, and it is believed that this was the trigger for Rodney's psychotic break the following year. In 1963, during Rodney's time in the Army, he went absent without leave, more commonly known as AWOL. While stationed at Fort Campbell near the Tennessee-Kentucky border, Rodney fled to Nashville, where he stole a car and proceeded to rob a person of their credit card. Taking the money, he traveled to New York City. According to the military report, after a night of drinking, Rodney took his leave from the bar, and he noticed a woman walking down the empty streets. He stalked her for a while, and then cracked her over the skull with a glass bottle. The woman was able to stagger back to her feet and escape the assault. After a period of time, Rodney made his way to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. There, he was arrested by the military, who charged him for going absent without leave. Yet Rodney managed to escape while being transported back to Fort Campbell. He snuck back to California to stay with his mother and his siblings. And during this time, he flashed his younger sister his penis, to which she became hysterical. When his sister was questioned about the incident, she wasn't sure if he was trying to seduce her. Rodney is tweaking a little bit here from his psychotic break in the military. The military reports called Rodney's behavior a nervous breakdown. A psychiatric assessment was performed, and Rodney was diagnosed with our favorite term here at the Fear Cult, antisocial personality disorder. which is characterized by impulsivity and irresponsible criminal behavior. Doctors stated that Rodney was manipulative, reckless, and had no concern for the empathy of others, and that he had no regard for right and wrong while appearing callous and antagonizing. It is believed by mental health professionals that Rodney was triggered early on by the trauma experienced by the abandonment from his father. And later, when Rodney was 19, his father passed away. And it was at the funeral when Rodney discovered that his father had remarried and had more children. And for a child that grew up resenting the fact that his father left him, only to discover later that he has been traded for a newer model in Rodney's eyes, that blood must have been stewing inside of Rodney's body. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Department of Center for Disease Control and Prevention explains that childhood experiences are the foundation of determining future mental and emotional stability. Parental separation and the feeling of abandonment, these increase the risk of anxiety, psychosis, depression, panic reactions, hallucinations, detachment, nausea, heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea, Pepto-Bismol. The list of abandonment issues runs deep, and with all of those symptoms, it's important for those suffering to seek therapy. And the interesting part is that the Army psychiatrists diagnosed Rodney with severe antisocial personality disorder, and he gets a simple fine and an honorable discharge from the Army at 21 years old in 1964. Rodney then moves back to California with his mother and enrolls in UCLA in the fine arts as a photography major. Let's continue. In early September 1968, 16-year-old Morgan Rowan had been enjoying a night out of dancing with her friends on the Sunset Strip. That's when a man who introduced himself as Rod invited them to go to dinner at a local IHOP. The group agreed and got into his car. Morgan's friend confessed that she had a crush on Rodney, thinking he was very handsome. Rather than driving to the restaurant, Rodney took them to his apartment in DeLongpre Avenue, not far from the IHOP. Rodney explained that there was a party in full swing at his place, and that he decided it was a better idea than going to dinner. Music blared, and there were many people at his place. So as Morgan wandered around the apartment, taking in her surroundings, Rodney dragged her into his bedroom and barred the door shut. With explosive strength and rage, Rodney tied her hands and shoved a belt into her mouth. He began punching her in the stomach, causing her stomach to bleed. The blood made its way up her throat, where she began to vomit. It would not be until half a century later, in 2021, when Morgan Rowan would feel brave enough to tell her story of how she survived the now infamous Rodney Alcala. Morgan told the Washington Examiner, quote, "I knew I was going to die. He tied my hands and put a belt in my mouth and punched me in the stomach until I vomited blood, and it was filling my lungs. I was drowning, and his rage was so apparent I knew he would kill me. I fought with every ounce of energy I had, and he started strangling me, and then I just felt myself drifting. There was no last-minute thoughts, but I do think I prayed for it to end at some point. It's very vivid to me." As Morgan began slowly fading under the evil of the monster, her friends had broken into the bedroom through a window. They stared at a half-naked man from the waist down standing over their friend. His shirt was soaked in Morgan's blood. Rodney spitefully instructed the group to just take her, as if he owned her. Struggling to breathe, Morgan began puking blood in the nearby alleyway with her friends. They pulled her into the cover of darkness, and the next thing they knew, a pair of headlights flashed against the dumpster they used to seek cover. Rodney had begun driving down the alley, and soon disappeared. Once Morgan and her friends got home to safety, they called the police. Morgan recalled the victim shaming that was at an all-time high in the late 60s, and besides her friends, no one else cared. The responding officer smirked at the girl and said, quote, "Boy, that's going to be a shiner in the morning. But what do you expect with your miniskirts and go-go boots? You went to this guy's house and into his room. I'm not seeing where this guy goes to jail for rape." The officer didn't even ask for a suspect or an address. He simply left. Morgan Rowan had kept her secret for years before bravely coming forward and contacting retired LAPD Detective Steve Hoddle, who was the original investigator in the extensive case against the dating game killer. It was September 25th, 1968, 3 weeks after the assault on Morgan Rowan. The sun was beating down on the West Hollywood concrete as 8-year-old Tali Shapiro was walking to school. Tali is the daughter of a well-respected music industry executive. Her family had been temporarily living at the famous Chateau Marmont after their home caught fire. Feeling a ruling presence next to her, she turned to see a car alongside her. Inside was 25-year-old Rodney Alcala. Rodney smiled and told her that he had a beautiful picture that he wanted to show her and offered her a ride to school. Telly explained that she didn't accept rides from strangers, and she continued walking. As the car began trolling beside her, Rodney claimed that he knew her parents. And in an interview with 2020, a grown Telly Shapiro detailed, quote, "I really didn't want to get into the car, but I was raised to respect my elders. I didn't know how to fear people." Somewhat feeling a sense of comfort, Telly entered Rodney's vehicle. He said that he knew her parents, and why would an adult lie to an innocent child? The car then pulled onto a main road and sped off. Little did Rodney know that a man named Donald Haynes had witnessed the entire encounter. Nothing about the scenario seemed right. And Donald tailed Rodney's car all the way to his apartment on DeLongpre Avenue. While on the way, Rodney told Tali that the picture he wanted to show her was back at his apartment. And as Tali began to feel scared, she contemplated leaping from the vehicle. She never got the chance. And when Rodney pulled her from the vehicle and forced her into his apartment, thankfully, Good Samaritan Donald Haynes called the police and waited until they arrived. It was Officer Chris Camacho of the LAPD who responded to the call of a possible child kidnapping. Knocking on the door, the officer could hear rummaging and decided to call for backup. To his surprise, a naked Rodney Alcala opened the door. He claimed to have been in the shower and that he would be back in a moment, closing the door. Officer Camacho thought to himself, this man didn't appear to have any water dripping off of his body, and he had no towel, and his hair was dry. Odd. The officer felt a lingering suspicion when Rodney didn't return promptly after 5 seconds. Officer Camacho kicked open the door and entered the apartment to hear silence, until he heard a gasp for air. While searching the bloody premise, Officer Camacho discovered a horrific sight, recalling, quote, she was unconscious, in a semi-spread eagle position with a bar across her neck. There was blood between her legs and blood all over the floor. Her skull had been bashed in and she had been violently sexually assaulted. Rodney had been suffocating her with a heavy steel bar across her neck when the officer had arrived. The bar was still in place and she was not breathing. Rodney had fled the apartment completely naked, and Officer Camacho had to decide whether to chase the predator or save the little girl. He made the correct decision and chose to save 8-year-old Tali. When the ambulance arrived, they took the little girl to the hospital, where doctors believed that she was going to die. Miraculously, Tali Shapiro survived, and she was in a coma for 32 days and received a total of 27 stitches to the back of her skull. When Tali awoke, she had no memory of the attack and had to relearn how to walk. Her parents never wanted to talk to her about the incident, and together they moved to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. When the investigators searched the apartment, they found a UCLA identification card and an array of inappropriate Polaroids of children in various stages of dress, photographed by Rodney. Detectives interviewed the professors at UCLA who insisted that it wasn't Rodney that they were looking for, they must have the wrong suspect, that he would never be the type to do such a horrific act. The police searched for Rodney, but he had vanished. It was assumed that he fled to Mexico, and then the case went cold. But Rodney never left the United States. He instead traveled to New York City. New York in the 1970s was practically bankrupt. Unemployment rates were sky high, and crime was rampant. Women were warned not to wear visible jewelry or carry money in public. The perfect place to hide in plain sight. In New York, Rodney changed his name to John Berger, and he got accepted into New York University, School of the Fine Arts, as an undergraduate. He studied under the famous filmmaker Roman Polanski, who was now most famous for being married to actress Sharon Tate, who would be murdered by the Manson family the following year in August 1969. During the summer, Rodney started working at an all-girls summer camp as an arts and drama counselor in George Mills, New Hampshire. The girls favored the charismatic man and spoke highly of him. Rodney was also working as a security guard at this time, and during his spare time, he was doing freelance photography. His niche was attractive young women and children, and Rodney would approach them on the street and ask to take their photos. Then occasionally, he would ask if they wanted to go to another location. In 1971, Trans World Airlines stewardess, 23-year-old Cornelia Michelle Crilly, had recently gotten an apartment on East 83rd Street in Manhattan with a couple of other female co-workers. The building where Cornelia lived did not have a lock on the main entrance, so both tenants and the public could enter freely. Based on the lack of forced entry to Cornelia's apartment on June 12th, it was believed that Rodney had climbed up the fire escape and entered through a window, or that he approached Cornelia on the street and possibly asked if she wanted to do a photo shoot, and she invited him inside at some point. Rodney attacked Cornelia, cramming her bra into her mouth and bludgeoning her skull. He proceeded to violently sexually assault her, and he left deep bite marks on both her breasts and left a nylon stocking that he used to strangle her wrapped around her neck. It wasn't until June 24th when her body would be discovered by police. Cornelia's mother attempted contacting her daughter for days, and when she didn't return her calls, her mother called Leon Bornston, Cornelia's boyfriend, and he went to her home and then called the police. A detective team comprised of 25 investigators went door to door looking for leads. New York had recorded a record high of 1,466 murders in 1971. Therefore, the city was already on high alert. The police ruled out robbery, and the case went cold. It would not be until 2011 when dental impressions would link Rodney Alcala to the murder of Cornelia Crilly. Back in Los Angeles, investigators were still hunting for the primary suspect in the kidnapping, rape, and attempted murder of 8-year-old Tali Shapiro. Police believed that Rodney had fled to Mexico, but this didn't prevent them from adding Rodney Alcala to the FBI's top 10 most wanted list. And in August of 1971, two female teenagers who attended the George Mills summer camp, where Rodney was employed under the alias John Berger, recognized that their counselor was on the top 10 most wanted list. So these girls, they stopped at the post office and seen this flyer, and they were freaking out. They rushed back to their camp and informed the camp's director, who then contacted the FBI. Soon after, Rodney Alcala was extradited back to Los Angeles, California. Now at the trial, the family of Tali Shapiro denied testifying. They didn't want their child to relive the traumatic experiences. So in turn, the prosecution arranged a plea deal where Rodney pled guilty to kidnapping, child molestation, rape, and torture while being acquitted of attempted murder. He received an indeterminate sentencing of 1 to 10 years in prison, meaning that a parole board had the power to declare Rodney Alcala rehabilitated at any point for release. And after only 2 years in prison for child molestation, a prison psychiatrist announced that Rodney was cleared for release while registering as a sex offender in Monterey Park, California. So currently, Rodney only has a criminal record of crimes against children, but that doesn't list attempted murder because he was able to dodge that one. So aside from Tali Shapiro, he has two separate crimes that he has not been convicted of: the attack and rape of 16-year-old Morgan Rowan in 1968, and the rape and murder of 23-year-old Cornelia Crelly in 1971. And those are the only ones that we know of. Remember, Morgan Rowan never came forth with her assault until 2021, and she survived. Rodney was very tight-lipped about his crimes. He mixed the ability to keep his mouth shut, and the lack of forensic science truly aided Rodney in his criminal career. And authorities believe that the number of Rodney Alcala's victims surpasses 130. Less than 2 months after his release from prison, he goes to Huntington Beach and he sees a 13-year-old girl who identified as Julie J, and Rodney is going by the new alias John Rowland, and he offers Julie a ride to school after learning her age. She accepts and she gets into the vehicle. And then when Julie sees that they're driving past her school, she freaks out and she attempts to jump out of the car. Now, Rodney starts fighting with her to keep her in the passenger seat, and then they get to a deserted area on the Pacific Coast Highway. He then leads her up to the hills where he forces her to smoke marijuana, and he French kisses her, and then he tells her he had the intent to be passionate with her. And luckily, a park ranger had smelt the weed and stopped the act before it progressed. Rodney is fresh on parole and is rearrested and charged with kidnapping and soliciting marijuana to a minor. So after serving 2 years in prison, he was again paroled in 1976 and moves into his mom's house. So he continues his freelance photography with young women and children, of course, and he manages to get a job for the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter. So clearly no background checks were run. And I laugh because Rodney would show his coworkers all of his portfolio Polaroids of naked children posing for him. And if anyone did their bloody homework, then this would have been investigated. But because no one knew that he was in fact a convicted child molester, this must simply just be art. Question mark? Curious face? Among Us music? I really don't know. It's gross and it's gross. So he would tell his coworkers that the parents of the children wanted him to take these photos. Spare me. Now the year is 1977, and it is the absolute worst year in history for the American serial killer. And when I say that, there was a plethora. It caused the police to backburner many investigations due to the influx in priorities, which had helped Rodney slip through the cracks. So let's clock all the American active serial killers of 1977. First and foremost, the one who irritates me to no end, aside from Rodney Alcala, Theodore Bundy. He was the most televised criminal in the media across the nation at this time because he continued to evade police by jumping from windows. Ugh. I can't get into Ted Bundy. Moving on. Killer clown John Wayne Gacy in Chicago. He killed 9 confirmed victims between the ages of 16 and 21, who he later buried under his floorboards. I did an episode on him. I also did an episode on Richard Chase, the Vampire of Sacramento. He was drinking blood at this time. The Hillside Stranglers, Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono in California, were active, as well as the Oakland County child killer in Michigan. The surge of murders in America caused everyone to panic, and Rodney Alcala was able to creep behind the curtains undetected. And that's exactly what he did on July 13, 1977, the historical New York City blackout that lasted for 25 hours, and over 3,000 people were arrested, and the city's prisons became overburdened. This is the exact same period as the Son of Sam murders in New York City, when David Berkowitz shot and killed 6 people and injured 11. So Son of Sam would outshine the next crime of our certified fruitcake, who traveled back to New York City after he manipulated his parole officer to let him go on a little vacation. While the city of New York lived on the edge, Rodney Alcala struck again on July 15, 1977, practically to the day of his last known murder. He approached 23-year-old college graduate Ellen Jane Hover and asked her to model for him. Ellen was the daughter of Herman Hover, owner of the legendary Hollywood nightclub Ciro's. Ellen's godfathers included actor-slash-singer Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. After introducing himself as John Berger, Rodney charismatically pressured her to have lunch with him, as explained by a close friend of Ellen's, noting that she was too gentle to say no. Time had passed, and Ellen's concerned mother contacted her friend Anita Feinberg regarding where her daughter was. Anita had not seen nor spoken to Ellen, and as 11 p.m. rolled around, the announcement of the 23-year-old missing girl was broadcasted over the news. When the New York police arrived at Ellen's apartment, they discovered no evidence of her whereabouts, except on her calendar. Written on July 15th, she had a date, written with a man named John Berger. The New York media covered the abduction of the missing socialite. Women who were on the streets witnessed a tall, dark, curly-haired man approaching women asking to take their photographs the day Ellen was last seen. Detectives investigated the identity of John Berger to discover the true identity of 35-year-old Rodney Alcala. New York detectives eventually questioned Rodney, who confirmed that he was with Ellen on July 15th. He vaguely recalled taking her to Westchester for a photo shoot and then dropping her off, emphasizing that she was alive when he last seen her. Without any concrete evidence or a body, Rodney Alcala was released as a suspect, and it would not be until 1978, 11 months after the disappearance, that the skeletal remains of Ellen Hover would be found, 30 miles north of Tarrytown, New York. No forensic evidence was left at the scene, and another case went cold. On November 10, 1977, the body of 18-year-old Jill Barcombe was discovered off Franklin Canyon Road in the Hollywood Hills. Jill had moved to Los Angeles from New York just 3 weeks before. Her body had been positioned half-naked, bent on all fours, with her head forcefully tucked into her chest to keep her body upright. Her head was so crammed into her body that it appeared as if her neck had been broken. The woman had been sexually assaulted, bludgeoned with a rock, and strangled with a pair of pants. She had deep bite marks that nearly severed her right nipple, and her pubic hair was singed. Her face was left unrecognizable. Blood had pooled around the corpse from the severe anal wounds inflicted by Rodney Alcala. Initially, investigators believed this crime to be the work of the Hillside Stranglers since it matched their M.O. Also, it had been an eerie coincidence that Jill's friend, Judith Miller, had been brutally murdered by the Hillside Stranglers less than 2 weeks earlier. Detectives concluded that there had been a first location, and that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the skull. There was no evidence linking any killer to the murder at this point. Rodney attacked next on December 16, 1977, and this time in Malibu, California. 27-year-old nurse Georgia Wickstead was reported missing by her co-workers. When the police arrived to perform a welfare check, they found that Georgia's house had been broken into. The window screen had been removed and placed neatly on the wall. Her naked body was posed on the floor with her limbs sprawled open. She had been sexually assaulted with a hammer, and it was left next to her body covered in blood, and her genitals had been mutilated post-mortem. Rodney had left DNA and a bloody handprint on the brass headboard. But without the forensic advancements of today, those clues would serve no purpose in 1977, not unless the perpetrator was standing right next to them. On June 24, 1978, the naked body of 32-year-old legal secretary Charlotte Lamb was found publicly positioned in the complex laundry room in El Segundo. This area of town was far from her home in Santa Monica, and the woman had been sexually assaulted and strangled with a shoelace that had been left wrapped around her neck. Her body was positioned face up, with her arms folded behind her back, causing her breasts to be exposed. The mutilation and body positioning were beginning to become Rodney's M.O. All right, the progression of violence in Rodney's crimes is insane. It's safe to say that of all the serial killers out there, Rodney Alcala had one of the largest egos. Even his own defense attorney would later go on to say that Rodney was a narcissist whose own arrogance was overwhelming, and his early crimes against Morgan Rowan and Tally Shapiro indicate that those probably weren't his first offenses just due to the rapid escalation alone. Tally Shapiro was just the first one he was caught on. He's now at the point where he's starting to take bodies to second locations and posing them, and that's seeking attention. And it's making Rodney an even more disgusting, complex individual that, even though he was positioning these victims for attention, once he was caught, he never bragged about it to the media, which is something you'd think a very narcissistic serial killer who was posing their bodies for police to see. And that just shows how confident Rodney was as a person. He was arrogant, and his crimes were his own personal enjoyment to relive no matter how much he was pressed for a confession. Ugh, could you just imagine the satisfaction of giving this guy a good old-fashioned chin check? You know, like some sweet chin music? So Rodney's court-appointed psychologist appeared on ABC's series 2020, The Dating Game Killer. Dr. Veronica Thomas had met with Rodney 5 to 6 times to administer assessments regarding his sexual interests and his crimes. Dr. Thomas said, quote, "Many times the rapist, slash killer, antisocial person will pose dead bodies, and they do want law enforcement and other people to see this, and there is a message in that. The message for Rodney is that I am here, you will remember me." End quote. Now most serial killers hide during the reign of terror. Rodney, he smiled and decided to go on the most public platform possible, public television. He took his predatory confidence and went on the popular game show, The Dating Game. He did this because his antisocial personality needed the attention and the grandiosity. If you've not seen the show, it's pretty straightforward. A bachelorette would ask questions to 3 hidden bachelors, and then she would choose one to go on a date with based on how they answered the question. And it was TV, so the more suggestive the questions and the answers were, the higher the ratings. Kind of like how Family Feud poses risque questions these days. So Rodney auditioned in 1978, and initially the show's executive producer saw Rodney as a charming creep, and he did not want him on the show. But the talent coordinators insisted that because Rodney was handsome, it would drive the female audience wild, so the producer changed his mind. So Rodney gets on stage with his Bijan Frise coif of hair and airplane spread collared suit and grins like a Cheshire cat. On the day of filming, Rodney entered the backstage green room with an arrogance and bravado that made the other two male contestants uncomfortable. Fellow contestant Jed Mills remembered how creepy and strange Rodney was. He recalled Rodney entering the room and stating obnoxiously, "I always get my girl." What premiered on television seemed to be a standard episode of The Dating Game. Rodney appeared charming and enthusiastic, which won over the audience. So well, in fact, that he even won the episode. But once he met Cheryl, she was less than impressed. Bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw had immediately gotten a visceral reaction upon meeting Rodney after she had chosen him as the winner. The next day, Cheryl called the show's producers, explaining that she was uncomfortable to proceed with the date with Rodney. He was weird, and she started to feel physically ill at the thought of going through with the date, a decision that very well saved her life. Psychiatrists explain that Rodney had used this rejection as an accelerant for his future crimes. On February 12, 1979, 36-year-old Rodney Alcala approached 15-year-old Monique Hoyt while she was hitchhiking to Pasadena. Using his charm, he persuaded her to go with him in his car. He explained that he wanted to take photos for a contest where both the winner and the model would get to share the prize money. Monique agreed and got into his vehicle. That evening, they spent the night together and engaged in sexual intercourse. The next day, Rodney had driven her to a secluded area in the mountains and proceeded to take photos of her in and out of clothing. She simulated sex acts with him, and at some point, these alleged sex acts ceased, and Rodney began choking Monique until she was unconscious. He then tied her wrists and ankles together and stuffed her shirt into her mouth. Rodney then bludgeoned, raped, and sodomized her. Afterwards, Monique used her own innocent charm on her attacker and convinced him that she was not going to go to the police if he let her go. Rodney then agreed to drive her to Riverside County, and along the way, they made a pit stop at a gas station. Once Rodney was inside the bathroom, Monique made a run for her life. She escaped and filed a police report. Rodney was then faced with criminal charges and had been released on bail. On June 13, 1979, 21-year-old data entry worker and college student Jill Parenteau was found dead next to her bed in her Burbank apartment. Rodney had sexually assaulted and strangled her to death. He continued by propping up her naked body with a pillow, revealing her breasts. Rodney had cut himself on the window when he fled the crime scene, and later, this would be used to link him to the murder scene. Unfortunately, this would not be for some years later. On June 19, 1979, two teenage girls were relaxing at Huntington Beach when Rodney approached them, asking to take their pictures for a bikini photo contest. He insisted that they go to another location to smoke marijuana. He then attempted to get their phone numbers. The girls followed their instincts and refused the offer. The very next day, on June 20th, around 2 p.m. at Sunset Beach, Rodney introduced himself to 15-year-old Lori Wirtz and her friend, Patty Elmendorf. The two girls were roller skating when Rodney appeared. He asked if he could take their pictures for a photography class, and Patty felt uneasy about the flirtatious man, and she said no. Lori agreed and began skating around while Rodney took pictures, and things became uncomfortable when Rodney began trying to convince Lori to leave her friend and go with him. Thankfully, Lori said no and carried on skating with Patty. Rodney packed up his things and left for Huntington Beach. He came across 12-year-old Robin Samso and her friend Bridget Wilvert. Much like before, Rodney approached the children and asked if he could take their pictures. Bridget quickly said no, while Robin hesitated. Seeing the contemplation in Robin's eyes, Rodney began rubbing her thigh, causing Bridget to pull her friend away. A witness had seen this interaction and rushed over and asked why Rodney was speaking to the young girls. This caused Rodney to pack up his things and flee the scene. The witness walked the girls back to Bridget's apartment around 3:30 p.m., and Robin said that she was in a hurry to a 4 p.m. ballet lesson at Beverly Fleming's dance studio. She was excited for class because she was moving up to toe that day, and she didn't want to be late. Robin also had been working at the dance studio to pay for her classes by answering phones. Bridget offered Robin her yellow Schwinn bicycle with turned-up handlebars so she could get there faster. And Robin was last seen on that yellow bike wearing a red t-shirt, shorts, and tennis shoes. At approximately 5:15 p.m., the dance studio called Robin's mother, informing her that her daughter failed to arrive to work. The last person to see Robin Samso alive was 21-year-old seasonal forest service worker named Dana Crappa. Dana had been stationed at Chantry Flats along Santa Anita Canyon Road. Dana testified that she witnessed a man and a small girl with long blonde hair walking up a ravine where a Datsun station wagon was parked on the road. The man was forcefully steering the girl up the gully. She explained that the man turned and looked straight through her. She believed that something might be wrong, but she continued driving. Later that evening, Robin's parents contacted the police and issued a missing persons report. A sketch artist met with Robin's friend Bridget and created a composite drawing that got distributed around Los Angeles. Following the release of the sketch, Rodney would then chemically straighten his hair and cut it within the following days. The next day, Dana Crappa was leaving work along Santa Anita Canyon Road when she admitted a near collision with the same distinctive Datsun parked on the road the night before. Beside the car was a man wearing Levi's and a stained t-shirt. It also appeared to Dana that the vehicle had dirt kicked under the tires. 5 days after Robin's disappearance, Dana returned to Marker 11. It was between 7 and 7:30 p.m. on the evening of June 25th, and with a flashlight, Dana walked up the ravine. She discovered a body with part of the face gone, and the head appeared to be next to the body. The corpse was unclothed and cut up, and she couldn't tell if the legs were hacked up, but the hands and feet were missing. Nearby, she saw a blue and yellow tennis shoe, shorts, and a t-shirt. She continued searching the area and found no weapons, only tire tracks. Terrified, Dana fled from the area and told no one what she had seen. On June 29th, Dana was a part of a spraying crew that included a coworker named William Pupke. While working, he stumbled upon a pile of bones in the area. Dana had seen the child's body days prior, so when William casually believed that the bones belonged to a deer and tossed one at Dana, She knew that they did not belong to an animal. Dana again returned to the site at marker 11. Using her flashlight, she saw a drawn-out skeletal body, missing a right arm. There was blonde hair along with a tennis shoe. It would not be until the trial when Dana was questioned about her reluctance to come forth with the evidence. She stated that it was caused by an overwhelming feeling of horror, guilt, denial, and depression. On the stand, Dana described reoccurring nightmares about each of the things that she had seen. And in each nightmare, the details were never identical. She was concerned that they confused her actual memory, and she wanted to be clear of her facts before she ever went to the police. Finally, on July 2, 1979, while spraying fire retardant at marker 11, William Popke found the decomposing skull of Robin Samso, and not far away was the rest of her mangled body. Robin's body had been savaged by wildlife, and her remains were in an advanced state of decomposition. The skull was decapitated at the neck, and her lower teeth were fractured in a manner that was consistent with a traumatic blunt force to the mouth. Also, the left foot and portions of her hands were missing. The cause of death could not be determined, nor could it be confirmed whether she had been sexually assaulted. Located a few feet from the body was a cane-cut kitchen knife with a drop of type A human blood. The tennis shoe was also recovered and had Robin's name written on it. Witnesses began reporting the strange photographer last seen with Robin Samso the day she went missing from Huntington Beach. The man matched the description of the convicted child molester Rodney Alcala, and not 15 minutes after looking for Rodney's criminal history, an officer turned on his television to see the episode of the dating game with their suspect that had been recorded 10 months earlier. Rodney called his girlfriend Elizabeth Keller multiple times after the murder of Robin Samso. He never told her of his crimes. He only discussed that he wanted to leave Southern California to move to Dallas, Texas. He had a plan on setting up a photography business. Rodney had still been living with his mother in Monterey Park, and he had begun packing for a trip that he was taking. On July 11th, Rodney traveled to Seattle, Washington. He rented out a storage locker where he moved all of his victims' trophies. This included jewelry and over 1,000 photographs of women, children, both male and female, in many pornographic situations. Days after his return on July 23rd, Rodney told his girlfriend that he had gone to Dallas and was going to go back the very next day. When the next day arrived on July 24th, the police obtained a search warrant and arrested Rodney Alcala. His Datsun was impounded, and inside was a briefcase that contained keys to an unknown storage locker. During the search of the residence, the officers found a receipt lying in plain sight for a storage locker in Seattle, Washington. One of the officers jotted down the information because he did not have the proper warrant to collect the evidence inside of the home. These officers returned the next day with a warrant to collect the evidence, but the receipt was gone. What was collected was a set of cane knives, matching the one that was near Robin's corpse. Articles of clothing were also retrieved, and a very specific set of gold ball earrings belonging to Robin Samso. What made these earrings special was that Robin's mother had previously used nail clippers to trim the earrings so they would fit her daughter comfortably. In court, an expert for the prosecution would testify that the earrings contained a pattern of striations similar to those produced by the nail clippers that belonged to Robin's mother. The yellow Schwinn bicycle that Robin borrowed was never recovered. Rodney denied ever being at Huntington Beach and that he never committed murder. He claimed that the sudden change in his appearance was coincidental and that his girlfriend encouraged the change. Upon cross-examination in court, his girlfriend admitted that Rodney did not act on her encouragement until June 23rd, a date following the publication of the composite sketch. While in custody, Rodney had been overheard talking to his sister in Spanish on the phone, where he mentioned the Seattle storage locker, saying it was good that they don't know about it. Officers then obtained a search warrant for the storage locker. It was secured with dual padlocks, which they were able to open with the keys that Rodney kept in his briefcase found in his car. At this time, the police had no idea the amount of unsolved murder cases they were about to blow wide open. Rodney was charged with robbery, kidnapping, lewd acts upon a child, and murder. Sadly, for the victims' families, this would only be the start of what began Rodney Alcala's fight for freedom over a 31-year span. The convicted child molester had only one goal for himself: avoid the death penalty. Rodney would profess his innocence and request that a jury impose a life sentence without the possibility of parole, rather than the death penalty, saying, quote, "In prison, I am not a threat to children. I am absolutely harmless." During the 12-week-long 1980 trial for the kidnapping and murder of 12-year-old Robin Samso, Rodney pled not guilty. The case had no physical evidence directly linking him to the murder, and what the prosecution utilized was the testimony of Forest Service worker Dana Crappa and two Orange County Jail inmates, Robert Dove and Michael Herrera. According to Robert Dove, Rodney claimed that nobody saw him take Robin and that he never stabbed her. He only slapped her unconscious. Rodney went on to explain to him that without the film and the bike, they could never convict him. Inmate Michael Herrera testified that Rodney loosely detailed how he lured Robin into his car. He offered to pay her for taking magazine photos and said that it wouldn't take long and that afterwards he would drop her off at her dance class. Once underway, Rodney locked the doors and drove down the Pacific Coast Highway. He did notice that Robin was worried and wanted to get out of the car. At some point, Rodney told Michael that he asked Robin if she had ever posed nude, and she began to cry. Rodney told Michael that he was slapping the shit out of her, and it was a weird situation. The child fell unconscious from the blows, and Rodney carried her into the mountains, where he would eventually leave her dead body. In the courtroom sat the mother of Robin Samso. Courthouses did not have metal detectors at the time, and she was able to smuggle a gun into the room with the plan to shoot her child's killer. In a later interview with 2020, Robin's sister explained that before her mother proceeded to retrieve the gun, her mother had heard Robin's voice telling her not to do it, so she stopped. The prosecution concluded with previous charges against Rodney, that he was more than capable of murdering Robin. Rodney moved for acquittal, and the motion was denied. 37-year-old Rodney Alcala was found guilty of first-degree murder and the use of a deadly weapon and forced kidnapping. He was sentenced to death in the gas chamber and was sent to San Quentin Prison. In August 1984, the California Supreme Court reversed Rodney Alcala's sentence for the 1979 kidnapping and murder of Robin Samso and granted him a new trial. The Supreme Court believed that Rodney's previous charges were not prevalent to the 1979 case, and this swayed the jury. The definitive reason was the ineffective assistance of counsel, which means that Rodney's defense team did not put forth a strong enough case to protect their client, leading him to not have a fair trial. Moving forward into the 1986 trial of the now 51-year-old Rodney Alcala, he was sentenced to death for a second time for Robin Samso's murder. However, a federal appeals court overturned the sentence again in 2003 due to a technicality regarding the testimony of Forest Service worker Dana Crappa. The trial court ruled that because prosecution witness Dana Crappa was unable to testify at the second trial because of a then existing mental illness or infirmity, her testimony was revoked. Dana's testimony from the first trial was read aloud without her being present at the second trial, and therefore the court ruled her statement as insufficient. He avoided the death penalty for a second time, and Rodney was given a third trial. By this point, the pain that Robin Samso's family was experiencing seemed never-ending. By the 2010 trial, prosecutor Matt Murphy had every intention of bringing final justice and closure to Robin Samso and her family. He was assigned to the case in 2003 and knew that it was not going to be easy. Rodney had escaped the death penalty twice, and he was going to make sure that that was not going to happen again. With all the new advancements in forensics DNA, Murphy knew that there must be new evidence to provide a strong case against Alcala. Murphy requested that the evidence in Rodney's Seattle storage locker be re-examined promptly. Examiners tested the jewelry and discovered that Rodney's DNA matched four other cold cases from the 1970s, confirming that Rodney Alcala was a serial killer who had murdered before. So in 1994, ego-driven Rodney writes a self-published book titled You, the Jury, where he published the full transcript from his second trial in 1984, and he pulls apart each section, arguing each witness testimony, and obviously pleads his innocence. I love reading long, extensive case laws. They are my primary sources for lullaby episodes, and the second trial, The People versus Rodney James Alcala of 1984, is one of the most fascinating case reads in my personal opinion. So to read Rodney's book arguing the trial was just super obnoxious. He is so full of hot air, and his diagnosed antisocial personality just bleeds through his words. I was sitting in my office researching, taking notes, and I kept looking at the invisible camera in my room like Jim Halpert from The Office. I couldn't get over this guy, but I digress. Now, the third trial starts in 2010, and 66-year-old Rodney elects to act as his own defense attorney. And he is charged with the murder of 12-year-old Robin Samso, yet again, and four brand new murder charges. 18-year-old Jill Barcombe from November 1977, 27-year-old Georgia Wixted from December 1977, 32-year-old Charlotte Lamb of 1978, and 21-year-old Jill Parenteau of 1979. There's this old law school proverb traced back to Philadelphia in 1809 that says, "A man who is his own lawyer has a fool for a client." And acting as your own defense is a very good way to trap yourself. And this only validates expert opinions on the narcissism that Rodney Alcala has for himself. He thinks that nobody in the courtroom is more intelligent than him. Boy, is he in for a razzle-dazzle of a lifetime, because in the trial, Rodney takes the stand in his own defense, and for 5 long, painful hours, he acted as both his own interrogator and as his own witness. He would refer to himself as Mr. Alcala and lower the register of his own voice when doing so. Now, if you ever get the opportunity to watch a trial, then I recommend finding the time to just focus on the reactions of the acting prosecutors and defense lawyers in the courtroom. Because if I were in that courtroom, even as a professional role in second chair, hearing for the first time Rodney doing this act. Now, I can poker face like no one's business, but in this scenario, I would need resuscitation. So even though laughing in the courtroom generally isn't considered contempt of the court, I would have to hold up a Looney Tunes sign between like snorts just to say, like, I mean no disrespect nor insubordination intended, but Your Honor, this bitch needs a recess. Which I probably wouldn't get granted either, but whatever. It would just, Rodney, stop. It's even hard to say. It's just hard to say that Rodney, he's such an idiot. Anyways, so Rodney attempted to prove that the gold ball earrings did not belong to Robin Samso because they were his. And then he uses footage from the dating game to prove that he was wearing them. Now, this was regarded as a load of crap because cast members didn't recall Rodney wearing earrings during filming, and that earrings on men were not socially acceptable in the late 1970s. And then to boot, Rodney's hair is so big in the video that you couldn't tell he was wearing earrings anyways. As the trial goes on, Rodney continues to claim that he is innocent for the murder of Robin Samso, but he doesn't attempt to dispute the 4 added charges because of the criminal classic, I can't remember. So then Rodney paid a psychiatrist named Dr. Rappaport to act as his defense witness, I guess, and testifying that Rodney had borderline personality disorder, arguing that that is why Alcala had no recollections for his crimes. Now the prosecution begins templating all the crimes committed against each victim using witnesses, and Rodney has no arguments or any cross-examinations for these witnesses until Dr. Sharon Schnitker, a board-certified forensic pathologist and deputy medical examiner for the Los Angeles County, who was also the coroner for the 1979 murder case of Jill Parenteau, she gets up there and speaks. Dr. Schnitker explained to the court that Jill's body had suffered horrendous injuries, including lateral tears to the corners of her mouth, probably caused by forced oral sex. So, Rodney decides to perk up and he all of a sudden wants to interrogate the witness. And this argument must be one of the most egotistical disputes Alcala will ever make. Honest to God. He had nothing to ask the previous witnesses, but now he wants to talk about the size of his dick. So he questions, if the tears were from forced oral sex, would they be inflicted by a large, girthy penis? Dr. Schnitker explained that any normal-sized penis could inflict such injuries with aggressive force. Rodney starts asking if a large, long sub sandwich could have inflicted the injuries. And the doctor just goes, doubtful. And this courtroom, the poor families are just sitting there listening to this fruitcake go on. Oh, Rodney, I'm so glad you get what's coming for you. On February 25th, 2010, Rodney James Alcala was convicted of 5 counts of first-degree murder from the span of 1968 to 1979 and was sentenced to death for a third and final time for the killing of Robin Samso, Jill Parenteau, Charlotte Lamb, and Georgia Wixted, as well as the assault of Tally Shapiro back in 1968. Tally had been a surprise witness during the penalty phase of the trial. In June of 2012, Rodney was extradited to New York after he was indicted for the 1971 murder of Cornelia Crilly and the 1977 murder of Ellen Jane Hoover. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Then in 2016, prosecutors in Wyoming charged Rodney Alcala with the murder of a 28-year-old, 6-month pregnant woman named Christine Ruth Thornton, who disappeared in 1978. Her body was discovered in a desert in 1982. Since then, Rodney has been linked to more murder cases in Los Angeles and Marin County, California, Seattle, Washington, in New Hampshire, New York, and Arizona. In March 2019, an executive order of moratorium on capital punishment was granted. This resulted in the delay of the death row executions in the state of California. During this time, those prisoners on death row would have their executions delayed as long as the moratorium exists. It is important to note that this act does not abolish the death penalty, it only prolongs it. On July 24, 2001, at 1:43 p.m., 77-year-old Rodney Alcala died of natural causes in his hospital bed in Kings County. When Rodney was incarcerated, authorities confiscated thousands of photos taken by the killer. Officers asked him to identify up to 130 young women and children. Rodney refused to divulge any information. The Huntington Beach Police Department has released a series of photos to help them determine whether they are potential victims of Rodney Alcala. Go to abcnews.go.com to view the photos and contact the Huntington Police Department if you have any information. That was the true story of Rodney Alcala, one of the most devious scoundrels to ever exist on this planet. The Alcala case has always been fascinating to me. The technicalities that were continued to let him off the hook, and the way he invaded investigators for years is very intriguing because it just drives one to insanity trying to mentally understand all of this. And now I'm not applauding Alcala by any means. It's only another study platform to research how criminals function. That's why I find it interesting. So thank you to Fear Cult members Christopher, aka Captain Cook's Food on Instagram, and Mitchell, Fear Cult member, for performing this episode's dramatization. So fun, always fantastic, and I'm contemplating doing an episode of just the dramatization bloopers because you guys, recording them is such an experience, and sometimes just solid comedy comes out of it because the... Let me know on Instagram at Lullaby the Fear Podcast if you would like an episode strictly of all the bloopers from the dramatizations.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
On our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 2023 remake of the 2014 Manson-inspired horror film, Last Shift. That's right, they made a remake, and it's titled Malum, M-A-L-U-M, The Demon. Now, I will say there are probably going to be mixed reviews on this film, and for that reason, if you watch it, I want you to watch it by picturing yourself as the main character. It really allows you to immerse yourself in the film and take away from anything you might think is ridiculous. That's what I do if I watch a movie that is, like, not very good. If you watch it from a perspective of that was you, it changes the experience 1,000%. So the plot involves a rookie police officer taking the last shift at a newly decommissioned police station where an officer murdered his fellow officers. And as I say, it's loosely based on the Helter Skelter murders by the Manson family cult. So I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. Follow Lullaby on Instagram at Lullaby the Fear Podcast. Thank you for listening to this week's Lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.